Welcome, everyone, to the Brand Fortress HQ podcast. I'm your host, John Stojan, and my co-host today is Mike Kaufman, and we have another Brand Builder episode for you. If you're an Amazon seller and want to share your story, you can apply at brandfortresshq.com/brandbuilder. Our guest today is Kyle Binder, the founder of Pet Lovers. Kyle, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, John. Thank you for being here, and thank you both again for amending your schedules to accommodate Thailand time.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you hear my voice is a little bit lower than normal, it's because it's a little early in this part of the world, but that's okay. We're excited to talk to you. Kyle, before we kind of dive into the business end of things, tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your e-commerce journey.
Yeah, sure. So I started selling on Amazon back in May of 2017. So now it's going on, it's at 7 full years soon. Back then, I just turned 28. And yeah, it was right before, I guess, my 21st birthday. And I had originally came into e-commerce. It was like a Tai Lopez ad that got me down the rabbit hole of making money online. And at that time, I was going to college full time. I was also working pretty much full time. I was working at Winn-Dixie. I was like a customer service manager. And I just remember it's like the classic unhappy, not enjoying like life. But for me, I felt like I could see enough into the future to be like, okay, I'm not really enjoying school. I never have. I don't absolutely hate it. I just don't get any satisfaction from it. And I don't know exactly what I want to do. I was kind of just going just to go. I was doing finance because I've always been interested in numbers, but I didn't want to be like a financial analyst, but I didn't know what else to do. So yeah, I was just kind of plodding along. And then I came across I think it was social media marketing agency ad. And I had made like 2 phone calls to local restaurants and very quickly realized I don't have the confidence to be like a cold calling salesman. And I wasn't really interested in social media. So that was like late 2016. And yeah, then I stumbled across one way or another selling on Amazon and I was instantly hooked. I just loved the whole idea of it. I thought it was ingenious and I moved relatively quickly. Like it was probably January or February when I stumbled across it in 2017. And then a couple months later, I'd placed the PO for my first product, which I'm still selling today. Well, not that listing, but it's lint rollers. I'm pretty open with my products. I understand not everyone is, and I completely respect it because it's all niche dependent and a ton of different factors. But yeah, and that's the start of it. Maybe very long-winded, but things really took off in like 2019. The first 2 years just kind of plodding along. Maybe we were at 5 to like 15,000 in revenue. And then in early 2019, I launched like a bigger pack of the lint rollers and things just really, really took off from there. And thankfully been growing nonstop since then. And yeah, bringing us up to today with a whole lot in between, but I'll start with that.
Okay. Well, and I think something that, I saw as kind of unique was, so as we mentioned a little bit earlier, you're in Thailand right now. What inspired you to move from the United States to Thailand?
Yeah. So I came here in 2019. And the reason why, when I was living in Tampa, Florida, I was looking for other online entrepreneurs, like ideally Amazon sellers, but just anyone who worked online. And I was having great difficulty finding them. Like I was just looking online for meetups or just local communities and I could find literally nothing. I haven't searched in a while, but I'm pretty sure a lot more exists now. And then I just came across like a YouTube video on Chiang Mai, which is in Northern Thailand. And it just got me thinking, like I had been living in an apartment for 4 or 5 months and I was like, I'm paying $100 a month rent. And then this guy's living in this really nice place and he's paying like $400 a month. And you know, I'm in my early 20s. I don't have anything tethering me here. Like, why don't I just go there? Because I want to meet more people working online as well. And that was kind of, it's like the digital nomad center of Thailand and really of like Asia at the time. So I flew into Bangkok and I actually had the idea of hopping around country to country, but I traveled with my dog and I realized how hard that is to internationally travel with like a large dog. I have a Siberian Husky and he's really the source of inspiration for the brand. He's on a lot of the packaging and the website and all that. So shout out to Jax the Husky. But yeah, I just realized that It was super impractical to be going from country to country like every 60 days. It's possible, but it's kind of like a full-time or like a part-time job on the side of preparing for paperwork and all this nonsense. And it also worked out that I love Thailand. So I just kept saying like, oh, I'm going to extend longer. And then maybe after like 6 months, I was like, okay, I'm just going to live here indefinitely.
Okay, very nice. Yeah, I think that awesome. That's awesome that you kind of took that leap and found a community, because I think that's, you know, we've had that discussion in a couple of different episodes in the podcast and just talking about the value in building a community. And in fact, that's, you know, kind of how this got started was, you know, Matt, Mike, and myself just kind of getting together, talking about, you know, issues that we're running into as far as running on building things on Amazon and building brands and that type of stuff. And there's just so much power in having a community to go to when you have issues that might be hard to solve yourself.
Right. And just to jump in there. Go ahead, Mike.
No, you're good. Go ahead. You're the one we're interviewing, not me. So,
sure. I was just going to say, I was listening to one of your Tactic Tuesdays. It was on launching the podcast. And I thought it was super interesting how you guys were talking about just barely cracking the top 100, which I thought was amazing. Like, congratulations on that achievement. But Mike was just talking about kind of like the idiosyncrasies of lining things up and getting them just right. And if you could go back and do it again in like hindsight. And yeah, I think it's amazing, really, just for such a kind of a niche topic like FBA. Congrats, guys.
I appreciate that. I think it comes down to the same thing, right? Like even in business, right? For if you're selling a product or a service, whatever that is, you know, you hear it a lot, but I don't think that people pay enough attention to it when they first start a business most of the time. And that is that idea of niching down, you know, and really finding where your sweet spot is, that mm-hmm. just right customer, you know, very specific product and how you're going to market it. And if you don't niche down like that, I think it makes it much more difficult because then you're kind of shooting at a moving target. You don't really know exactly who you're marketing to. You don't really know yep. exactly what your product is. And so, you know, that niching down really makes a big difference. I mean, in your case, right? You sell yep. lint rollers, like this is what we do, right?
Four packs.
And it doesn't mean, right. of course, that, you know, down the road, you can't reach out to other products, but right. niching down and being very specific with who you're selling to and what you're selling is very effective in the beginning.
Oh, 100%. And it was lint rollers for pet hair, just to build on that, that made the difference, like specifically going after that keyword, because I remember distinctly like 7 years ago, the search volume for lint rollers for pet hair was like 11,000 versus lint rollers was maybe like 40 or 50,000 a month. And I was like, all right, if I go after lint right. rollers, I'm competing against 3M and the Chinese, which are still the competitors today. Surprise, surprise. But yeah, if I brand it and go after lint rollers for pet hair and even the brand name, super, everything was really, really intentional, like Pet Lovers, because initially I was thinking of just kind of a more generic name, like making up a name or something. And that way we could sell kind of anything. But I was like, no, I'm going to just go all in because I love dogs. Really, it's should be dog lovers, but no, I love cats and all types of pets as well. But yeah, I wanted to name it ideally something that I could connect with and be much more motivated to sell whatever products we sell. If I could just be stoked about the brand itself, which I think, like I said, once I added Jax on the packaging in like early 2019, combined with launching like a better offer, things really, really scaled. And I think that's just been the continued source of me to keep going and keep pushing is just because I made it something I genuinely care about. And there's also the other alternative, which I think is completely fine and respectable business-wise, is just like, I'm just going to find something to sell and then build on that. And I actually strongly recommend, I mean, I think now with kind of market dynamics changing, I would strongly recommend that you do a passion product if possible. However, if someone stumbles upon a niche that they think looks great, and maybe it's like, I don't know, a set of storage spice racks in your kitchen cabinet, maybe you don't need to love spices, but if you think it's a great opportunity and you're super, you got a great feeling, all of the metrics seem to check out. And by the way, I'm not actually recommending Spice Racks. It's just something that popped in my head. Then go for it.
Sure. Well, I think knowing your audience is a big thing. So that's why on the one hand, I don't like the idea of, you know, sell what you're passionate about, in the sense that I think far too many entrepreneurs aren't really that. They start doing something they like, but they don't dig into the numbers. They don't do the testing. They don't do the things that make it an actual business. It's really more of a hobby that makes some money. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, I don't like that, because sometimes if you enter into a space that you don't know, it forces you to do some of those things. But on the other hand, like you said, when you're selling into that space that you are passionate about, the one thing that it does do for you, and if you're focused on this and you understand the value of it, then I think it's a very good thing. And that is, you can connect with the audience. If you recognize how important it is to be marketing to a very specific individual, then if you're selling in a category that you really enjoy and you're passionate about, you know who that person is. You know how they think, you know how they operate, what they get emotional about. And so as long as you're using it properly to your advantage, then it's a huge step up. And so if you can find something that you're passionate about that you want to sell in that category, I do recommend it, as long as you understand that the value of it really is mostly in, you now understand your target customer extremely well, form a relationship with them, and that's going to be your bread and butter.
Well, I think that, you know, the best way that I've heard this put so far is in the episode that where we interviewed Bradley Sutton, because he talked about, you know, if you've seen Project X before, he does like coffin shelves, which is a little bit off the wall. Yeah. And what I found was really interesting about that, when I was talking to him, I was like, hey, how did you get to coffin shelves? Since I know they documented it, but I think that YouTube video is probably like 5 years old by now, and they've got, you know, thousands out since then. Yeah. And what I found interesting about that is... Yeah, yeah. And what I found interesting kind of to this topic out of it was that, you know, he saw an opportunity in kind of Gothic decor that actually wasn't even from data on Amazon. It was actually from a different source. So first of all, you know, looking at other sources, I think in this case, it was Etsy or Pinterest or something like that, as far as doing product research. But then the other funny thing is it's not like, you know, Bradley had any sort of, you know, super strong affinity or personal interest in in coffin shelves. But what he did was he said, okay, well, if this is the opportunity we're going to go after, I'm going to be a world expert in coffin decor, you know, kind of Gothic decor. And I think whether you're passionate about a particular, you know, niche or brand or product, or if it's, you know, just for business purposes, either or, really at the end of the day, what matters the most is that you are an expert in that niche in order to serve your customer base, because I think that's what's going to really set you apart, especially like you said, you know, with all the Chinese sellers and other overseas sellers, as things get more competitive, what your customers are really looking for is a brand or a product that really speaks their language, talks to their pain points, has some personality behind it. And you have to be an expert in kind of who your core audience is and who your core customers are in order to be successful in speaking to them and solving their problems.
Completely agreed. And using Bradley's example, like, you don't need to be passionate about the Gothic. What were they like? Gothic. What was it again? I'm blanking.
The coffin shelves.
Coffin shelves, right.
Yeah, and Gothic decor, yeah.
Right. But one thing that I think is clear is he's passionate about selling on Amazon, especially like in that series, right? So if you can be passionate about the process versus the individual product, one or the other, or both ideally, but you can still get amazing results. And I think that's where so many Amazon sellers connect with. Like, most of them, like I said, going back to the beginning, or even if, whether you're just starting out or you're seasoned, I'm assuming, you know, most of the people listening are a couple of years in, just that process of, oh, I found a new product, and going through and doing product research and getting super excited and contacting suppliers. I think that's super important, and maybe even more important than loving your product or the brand itself, because that's the actual operations of the business. So it's better to be passionate about the operations probably than just the idea or concept itself. I mean, it's hard to say, but
yeah. Well, and speaking of kind of, you know, being passionate about the process, one of the things I noticed in my notes was, you know, kind of going deep with a brand is that you're in a number of different marketplaces at this point with your brands. I'm curious, what's your process for kind of deciding which marketplaces to go into and what order, and what are maybe some of the challenges that you've seen as you've expanded marketplaces?
Sure. So initially, when we had first started expanding back in, I want to say 2021, when we first started going into a bunch of countries, I just simply looked at all of them and sorted by revenue. And it was that, well, not just revenue. Like, I did the numbers for the actual margins. Like, if we were to go in at our target price, let's say in, you know, Germany, 15 pounds for this pack of lint rollers, like, what are the competitors doing? How does it look? And then what are the actual realities of selling? Because let's say, for example, Amazon India, which I did look into like many years ago, and even I re-looked into it recently, you need to set up a separate legal entity, and to set that up, like, it's a lot of hoops to jump through. And there's actually pretty decent revenue for us in India, but it just doesn't make sense, the process of setting up that company. So that's not something we've done. So it's like, yeah, the feasibility of what are the market dynamics, like, is there enough sales there for it to make sense to send in inventory, sales and profit? And then number two is just like, how realistic? India, you have to set up an entity. Brazil, you have to set up an entity. Mexico as well, which we're selling in Mexico, and we actually set one up. So yeah, I think just demand and then feasibility of actually selling there, which is usually going to be a company that you have to set up for that country. Like, at least, like I just said, for those three examples of Mexico, Brazil, and India.
So I'm curious, for Mexico, did you test, I always get the name wrong, of what NARF, or, you know, what I think is North what American. Amazon used to call it, yeah. And now it's called remote, yep. FBA. And I'm curious if you tested that out, and if so, you know, kind of what your experience was with that.
So we did. It was automatically activated. And I want to say I just saw a couple units being sold there. It wasn't a lot. And at that time, I mean, we didn't sell super long. I think it's been like a year and a half, maybe 2 years, probably 18 to 24 months since we started selling in Mexico. And I think Helium 10 was already showing sales data. It was, but it was definitely off. I could tell it was off because I just did the classic like review rate reverse calculation. Like, how many reviews is this listing getting? And it's like, let's say 3M's lint roller listing was getting, I don't know, 10 reviews a month or something like that. But it was saying it was only selling like 30 units a month. So it's like, okay, these estimates are very wrong. And I think that's something that's valuable even to this day for anyone listening, is a lot of times Helium 10 revenue estimates in non, let's say, tier one countries, like anything outside of really US, Canada, I guess would be that, in Europe, if you're even in Japan, Japan's pretty good, but like it's wrong. Australia's to this day very, very off. Mexico is very off. So just be careful in these like smaller countries on taking that as law, because they're very often very, very underestimating, I'm finding, in the smaller, less established countries where they have less data.
And less history overall, because those marketplaces are still fairly new, many of them. So, you know, right. the historical data, yeah. is difficult to come by there. But, so, you know, you sure. can't fault them, but at the same time, you know, you got to be careful about that data for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
So are you selling?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to ask. So are you, so you set up an entity in Mexico. So I assume you're selling directly in Mexico and you're not using remote FBA in order to sell in that market. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Actually sending in inventory to Mexico, and it takes forever. The shipments are really slow. Customs clearance is a pain in Mexico, and you need, the reason why you need a company is you need, I think it's RF, I want to say RFID number, but that's the Mexican like import entity number that you need. And I think customs clearance in Mexico takes, maybe it's like 2 weeks, I want to say, because our shipments have been taking routinely like 75 to up to 90 days. I think one was like 6 months ago. It was so long that Amazon closed the shipping plan, and then they couldn't deliver it. And then we had to make seller support cases. And it was just,
oh, really?
Yeah, it was a bit of a nightmare, but it's worth it because the sales are pretty solid there for us. And it just takes more planning and strategizing on inventory and pricing.
So on that front, Kyle, it, I guess maybe or a couple of related questions would be, of the marketplaces that you've entered, which mm-hmm. ones do you feel have been the most fraught, let's say, with those types of logistics problems or, you know, paperwork issues or, you know, administrative type stuff? And then I guess secondarily to that, have you found, let's take Mexico in relationship to that. You said it's worth it. How, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, oftentimes I think when we're running businesses, we don't always account for the miscellaneous, you know, crap that we deal with yeah. for certain strategies or things that we're doing within our business, that if we really step back and evaluated them more directly, we would say, actually, this strategy is not worth implementing. Like, we shouldn't yep. actually be doing this anymore, even though there's maybe some decent revenue there or whatnot. We're actually losing way more than we thought on this side. Mm-hmm. We need to stop doing that and move a different direction. What are your feelings on that?
Actually, Mike, before we jump into that, if I could just just clarify one thing, because I'm curious about, because I think this is important for listeners, because, you know, Amazon really pushes remote FBA. And I'm really yep. curious, you know, so my guess is, based on our conversation, is there's a reason why you chose to send inventory directly to Mexico, Amazon Mexico, as opposed to using remote FBA. Could you, you know, before, Mike asked some great questions, but before we move on to that, right. could you give a little bit of background as to what drove that decision to work with yep. Amazon Mexico directly as opposed to through remote FBA?
Sure. Yeah. So remote FBA, think of remote FBA in our experience, and I think most products, as being basically out of stock, or when you're out of stock, but your inventory is on the way and your listing is available and it says your products will be delivered in like 3 to 4 weeks, or sometimes it says 1 to 2 weeks, whatever it says. That's kind of like the handicap that I found. Like, we were doing, I can't remember exactly, but I know it was something like 70 to 80% less sales with remote fulfillment versus as soon as we sent in inventory. And I think it makes total sense, because customers don't want to wait globally, whether they're in Mexico or the States. I'd imagine the States is, you know, even more like, we need it now versus Mexico, but it still applies. Like, someone's like, I don't want to wait, you know, 7 days, and they have to pay import tax. So even when you try and accommodate that on your price, I think they see that, the psychological factor of like, oh, this is being imported and I have to wait longer, versus something that's available for Prime delivery immediately, is contributes to that, like 80, I think it would be 80%, because we weren't selling much. And to go into what Mike said, which I completely agree, Mike, and that's why something like using India as an example, I thought about, like, well, should I have someone set up an Indian company, and is it worth it to jump through those hoops for that amount of money? And I think ultimately how someone should quantify it is, look at the revenue forecast and try and get, Mike, you made a really good point on the miscellaneous costs. And one thing most people don't factor in is the value of their time, which is just something I can't stress enough. However, it depends on what phase you are in your business. I would say if you're at mid to high six figures, or maybe really low seven figures, and you're at a point where you can still dedicate tons of time, then maybe you can set a lower value to your time. But if you're at a point in your business where it's like you have systems built out and employees and you have leverage, well, then your time genuinely does have a pretty good value. So you have to factor in your time, your employees' time, like the amount of time that would be spent on the project, and then the amount of sales that you think would come in. And it's a balancing factor of all three of those. But what I found with expanding, Amazon is, I'm sure as you both know, like, it's very front loaded, right? So it really is just thinking about, say, using Mexico. How I thought about it was, okay, I think my initial estimate was we could do $10,000 a month in sales there. And it's going to cost me, let's say, $3,000 to set up the company. And then the company, you have to factor in the monthly accounting costs, the compliance, all that. I was like, let's say all in the company to set it up and keep it running without me having to invest too much time, and the compliance would be around $6,000 to $7,000 a year. So to me, I just did the math. It's like, okay, $10,000 a month, 25% margins target, so like $2,500 times 12 is like 30 grand. So 30 grand, the 7 grand in costs, that's just for the compliance, but then I have my time and all that. But it's not too much, because it's really getting that company set up. So it's not like I have to invest, you know, 2 months of time like planning out this Mexican company when I can just hire another company to set up the business, which is ultimately what I did and what I recommend people to do. Well, I mean, my case of living abroad made it so much more complex to set up a Mexican company. So I ended up literally just buying like a kind of a dormant company and getting their RFID number, the import number, through that entity. And that's how we did it, instead of, like, I would have had to get all these documents legalized and notarized, which is these like steps to go through within Thailand, which was super difficult. So I ended up just buying one. And that's a tip I would give someone if they wanted to sell in Mexico and they're willing to just save that time. Because I think even if you're not living abroad, I think it's a bit of a pain to set up a company. I think I only paid $3,000 or $4,000. So if you're in a position where it's like, oh, I might have to spend 6 weeks of submitting paperwork back and forth, or I can just spend $4,000 and literally be done with it instantly, I would strongly recommend that. But I hate paperwork. Like, I'm horrible with it. Like, I'll procrastinate filling out like half a sheet of paper for like 6 weeks, even if it would just take like 2 minutes. I'm bad with it.
Well, you're not the only one, Kyle.
I was gonna say. I feel like that's a lot of entrepreneurs. I'm definitely fond of that as well.
My wife gets very upset at me for the number of things that I don't do that I should do on the paperwork side. She's like, would you just get that done, please? But Kyle, honestly, I mean, yeah. I'm sure there's going to be plenty that we talk about that people are going to walk away with. But that actually is a big tip that you just provided to anybody who potentially is looking at moving to other marketplaces, because I would imagine that potentially that tip would apply not just to Mexico, but to other countries as well, where you might have to set up these additional entities and whatnot, and that there is potentially a lot of paperwork involved, is that purchasing a dormant company of some sort, you know, I don't know what that process looks like. And I guess, John, you could decide whether we want to dig into that a little bit. But that, to me, actually sounds like a really good strategy for entering into a marketplace a little faster. And you always have to take into account the lost opportunity cost. So if you're going to take, you know, 2 or 3 months to be filling out paperwork and doing all of this stuff to get yourself set up so that you can actually start selling in any particular marketplace, you have to account for how much money am I losing by not yet being able to sell in that marketplace versus buying this dormant company, which maybe speeds the process or cuts it in half. And now I can be selling, you know, that much sooner. So,
well, and in fact, actually the other direction that I'd love to take this, because you mentioned that you sell in Japan, Mexico, all these different marketplaces, is mm-hmm. I'm really curious from a listing perspective, are you keeping that same listing across all those marketplaces, which has the advantage of, obviously, you know, your reviews translate over, which is a huge advantage. However, the downside of that, talking with, you know, other sellers and experiencing some of this myself with, you know, brands that we work with, is, you know, Amazon is far from perfect when you look at across marketplaces. And sometimes, you know, things that you put into your listing for the Mexico marketplace ends up in, you know, the US marketplace or one of your other marketplaces. So I'm curious, can you share a little bit of, you know, maybe your experience with that and some best practices, if you have them, for how you manage that across numerous marketplaces?
Yes. Yeah. So this is something that we've dealt with and had issues with. Our second biggest ASIN, I have a theory. So the reviews randomly stopped sharing like a year and a half ago. And I think it's because we had an issue, like some probably overseas sellers put in a bunch of like illicit keywords in the back end. And I think that's like permanently removed one criteria, like the trust authority of the listings, to allow the reviews to globally share. But I'll expand on that more later. As far as dealing with, let's say, your titles change and all that, the best thing is Helium 10 has the feature to where if any change happens on your listing, then an email is sent out. So we do utilize that. But it's also just a lot of manual checking. Like we do, I even myself, mostly just due to interest, I don't need to, but I just constantly will check. Not every single country, like every day, but I'm constantly checking the US, like our bigger marketplaces, just out of curiosity and like market dynamics. I'm always searching like lint rollers. It must be like 1,000 of those searches a month out of the whatever it is just coming from me. But yeah, it's having those notifications set up and then manual checking as well. Like I would definitely, we have someone who tracks our listings and he looks through them as just like you go through feedback management for each country. Like that's also a minor tip, but I want to remind people selling internationally, like, you know, you have your, even though we're FBA feedback manager, you're the people leave you a 1-star, which you can actually remove easily just by requesting it. Make sure you do that in your other countries, because although we're FBA, it does matter. It is taken into account for your account health. So keep up with that each month, go through and check them all.
So to clarify then, Kyle, so you are in other marketplaces, you are reusing the same ASINs in those other marketplaces. And originally the review count was transferring over, the reviews were. Over time, that stopped happening. And you can correct me, John, but I thought, maybe I'm wrong because we don't actually sell in other marketplaces at this point. I thought that there was a point at which that might occur anyways, once the review threshold was kind of passed in that marketplace, that they would just show those from that marketplace after a certain point. Maybe that's not correct. But my question though, Kyle, with regards to that is, how many issues do you actually deal with, let's say over the course of a month, of listings getting messed up because of something that you did in another marketplace? So you've got that, let's say, cross-contamination of the ASIN.
Yes.
Because it's always this balancing game for somebody selling in another marketplace. How difficult have you found that process in terms of those back and forth issues that you run into? Is it a constant thing or is it really pretty infrequent?
So I will say, I think we're lucky because I've known other sellers who deal with so many more issues. Like the most severe issue is that like back-end keywords that got our listing taken down, and it was one of the countries in Europe, but it is very infrequent. So the biggest issue we have is someone will go to update the title on the root seller account, and it'll globally update the title in all countries, even though we have country specific uploads. Like whenever you just go to edit the ASIN via the regular manage inventory feature, it'll globally update, you know, in all your countries, except for your country-specific countries. Should be. However, sometimes it still does. So that's our biggest issue. Like we have it right now, actually. We had merged a couple listings together, and then the parent listing is now the title for all of the child variations in Europe. And it's things like that. It's usually just title updates that end up being across all countries, even though they're supposed to be localized, like the countries like Japan, which are localized, should not be affected by the global updates, but sometimes they are still. But I think we're lucky because, yeah, we've only had one serious issue with having to appeal it. And thankfully that went over relatively easily. Like seller performance or seller support was reasonable and realized that this is clearly just an attack.
Okay. Mike, were there other questions that you want to have, or is now a good time to kind of pivot into the second half and talk challenges and that type of stuff?
Yeah, no, I think this is a good pivot point.
Okay. So Kyle, what we'll do is we'll pivot into the second half of the podcast episode. And then, you know, if you want to share maybe some of the challenges you have right now or questions that you have, anything that we can do in order to help you kind of move, you know, the brand or your Amazon side of things forward.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the biggest one, which would be a tough one, which has been our like sort of multi-year problem, which is how do you meaning or sustainably get external traffic to convert on lint rollers, which is, it's a tough, It's a tough question because I've talked to so many, let's say a Facebook ad expert, like specifically experts within the pet niche for Amazon companies and D2C companies. I've talked to so many people and tried so many different ways, you know, Facebook ads. We did social media and we got a couple sales from that, but we were always going for, my plan was for engagement. So we didn't even really mention products all that often. We still made a couple sales, but my strategy long-term was to build up a passionate audience and then be able to sell it to them, lint rollers or anything else, just because they are, you know, connected with the brand. Ultimately, I had stopped doing that, not to make it too much of a tangent, just because I was using my dogs and it became too intertwined with my personal life. It was smashing it. Like, we got millions and millions of views, but I just shut it down cold turkey because it was not worth it on my personal life with that setup. But I kind of lost my train of thought. What was the original question there? That social media took me off the rails.
Well, let's go ahead and dig into that. So the idea there was, we need external traffic. We know that it would be useful to build out an audience and be able to sell to that audience. And then, of course, obviously that's all external. So you went through that process of utilizing social. It would be interesting to know which platforms were performing for you and which platforms you were attempting to use. But your suggestion is that whatever that was, you were generating millions of views, but it really wasn't generating much traffic or sales in relationship to that number of views. And so you shut that down, partly because it wasn't generating and partly because it was just overrunning your personal life. Where were you marketing? What platforms were you using? And then what were you doing specifically to try and convert that traffic into sales?
Yeah. So I will say it was purely just the personal life. Like, I literally said, we're not going to push anything for like at least a year. We're not even going to show lint rollers or our products. We're just going to make videos of like my dog's getting a bath. And that's what we did. And it was working extremely well. And just have the brand mentioned. Like, I always wear like the t-shirt. I have branded t-shirts and that's just what I wear. And that was the strategy, just to get awareness. Right. But what we focused on was short form content. Okay. And the reason why, so primarily TikTok, and that is what worked best. I had hired someone in Thailand who is a social media influencer himself, and he had just come across the job post and he was super interested in the idea of it. He liked the brand. And so I lucked out in that regard, because usually people who are ultra successful on social media are not going to be applying for a social media job. But it was a really unique case because he's living in Thailand as well. So he knew TikTok extremely well. And I think that's the primary factor of it working so well, is he was really good at creating short form content. And that's a great tip I can give to the audience, is when I've looked at tons of brands' social media, an expert in that, but just from an observatory perspective, it's so easy to tell who has paid someone, you know, like outsourced it to a cheap agency, and then who has someone who's actually turned on with social media. I would say find someone who genuinely loves to create videos to do your social media, because it's going to show and it's going to reflect in the quality of the content and I think the actual output. But yeah, so since we weren't ever really pushing products, like, we were getting probably a viral video like every few weeks and probably 1 to 2 million views a month on TikTok. But I just, to answer the question about sales, we had just put a link tree up and we just listed links to our products. And there was, we're talking maybe like a couple hundred dollars of sales a month, but that's without even mentioning them, just putting the links up. So my plan was to start doing ads to the viewers, the longtime viewers, based on the percentage of watch time and who has been watching the longest. That was going to be my way to monetize it and actually make it sustainable. And the reason why I want to take such a long path is because it's like, well, we're selling lint rollers and we've sold other products and we have other products which are successful. But the core has always been lint rollers, and that's still, it's what keeps growing. It's what keeps us going. So I was like, that's the best way to sell. It's like trying to sell a pack of screws. You know, it'd be pretty difficult to make a Facebook ad. Like, use my screws next time you need to, I don't know, make a carpentry project. So I wanted to just build a real connection and build loyalty with the audience and then make the ads with my dogs. And like I said, it just wasn't really working out. But I think for anyone listening, it totally is possible. That's one thing I want to say. I had a serious doubt from the start of like, I'm not really a social media person. Like, you know, I love being behind the scenes. Can we even do this? And it's like, it is possible, even if you're not a social media person, if you have the right person doing the creative. So that's the lesson there, is like, it needs, but if you don't like it, and then you hire someone else who really doesn't like it, and they're just doing it for their job and it's outsourced, you're probably not going to get results. That's what I've seen time and time and time again. When there's brands that are doing well in social media, it's usually because the creators are, there's like genuine buy-in to the success of the videos and the production process, or they have an extremely good expensive agency. It's like one or the other. And most Amazon sellers aren't going to want to pay that, you know, like $20,000, $30,000 a month for social media. And I wouldn't recommend that either.
What does, for Lint Roller, I mean, what do you see from your customers in the sense of, we have a cat and a Lint Roller is pretty much my experience with that. Right. So I'm just curious, like, do you see a lot of repeat orders from people, or is this pretty much like, hey, I buy one and I'm good for, you know, 3 years? Or is it like, hey, I buy one every 3 months?
Mm-hmm. So there is a good amount of repeat orders. It's frustrating that brand analytics data is so wrong, like pretty much all Amazon data. But it's roughly like, via reverse engineering, the sales on our packs of refills, which are heavily brand searched. And let's say they sell like 4,000 units a month, and like half of those come from search. And then you take the overall units and divide it, do all the math. It's roughly like 7 to 10% repeat sales out of our, so it's not massive, but we have almost say like 15,000 people in Subscribe and Save, and just building that up through time has been huge. And only in the last couple months has that growth slowed. So I'm making that point because most people seem to stay on it for years. But it's also hard. It's hard to have exact numbers because Amazon doesn't really give enough data, in my opinion, on Subscribe and Save. Like, I can't see, there's no report, at least to my knowledge, that see how long a customer has been on Subscribe and Save. We can only do it by just seeing the growth month over month and tracking that through time.
Right. So, sorry, good, John, looked like you were going to say something.
Well, I was just curious. So right now, are you using any sort of insert in your product or any sort of process in order to collect kind of, you know, an email address or something like that, so you can have more of a relationship with customers?
Yeah. So we've done a couple of methods. Right now we have a really like boring insert, just a typical like 25% off scan here to get your coupon, and then like a cute picture of my dog, and like a, on the back I have like a handwritten message, but it's still printed like a standard insert. And the scan rate is not great. It's like probably, I think I just checked the other day and it was like maybe 0.5% or 1%. But prior to that, I do have a method that I want to share it's actually completely white hat, but Amazon would view it as black hat because it offers something free, but there's no exchange of anything. And I've been thinking heavily, I really want to re-implement it because it works so well. But it was a tip I got from someone. His name is Anthony, and I met him at an Amazon event in 2019, the first one I meant to. So first one I went to. So shout out to Anthony. Thank you. Offer a free item in exchange for their information. There's a, let's say like a form that they would fill out on your website. And at the end, after they filled out their information, we were offering a free, it was either a dog or a cat toy. And we just drop shipped them off of AliExpress until it got to be like 1,000 people a month and like 1,500. And then doing 1,500 orders a month on AliExpress is not good. And then payments kept getting blocked. So we had switched to a 3PL in China to be able to fulfill them. But anyways, back to the offer. You offer a free gift, and it's in exchange for their information, really. But to them, it's just free. And at the end, we would ask, will you leave us a review? But it's not required, unlike most of the free inserts that's like free this, free gift card, whatever, but give us your order ID and a screenshot of your review. It wasn't required at all. And most people didn't. Actually, the stats were like 77% of people said yes, but actually almost no one ended up doing it, even though the next click took them to leave a review. But that worked extremely well from a standpoint of actually collecting customer information. And the scan rate was like, I want to say like 3%. Maybe it was even higher, because at that time we were getting, I think at peak, like we got maybe 1,200, 1,400 people in a month. And our sales, we probably only did 25, maybe 30,000 units in that month, probably 20 actually. But yeah, like it was quite good. And the cost for that free item was about $2.50 to $3. So considering it was increasing review rate, like I said, it wasn't super effective in that regard, but it's a multifaceted thing, because you get someone's information, which we still get sales off of those customers via email marketing now, information, and you increase your review rate. However, you're offering something for free, which I think now actually with Amazon's revised TOS, no matter what, would be incentivizing reviews. And even, but to me, if you're not requiring it, and you're still directing them off of Amazon onto your own website as well.
My biggest suggestion with that, Kyle, is that, you know, going back to what you just said, which is, you know, incentivizing reviews, right? That's right. The point at which there has to be, in my mind, the biggest thing that you could do in that that would push the needle in the direction, let's say, of being, you know, entirely white hat, is just set a really big space between those two, you know, functionally within the process.
Yep.
I wouldn't ask for that review until I'm, you know, X number of months down the road, however long it is that, you know, my guess would be that you have some numbers to gauge how long most customers have a lint roller before they need a new one. So how long they, you know, like, so you would want to be asking for that review down the road. You've got their information. As long as you're continuing to follow up with whether it's, you know, useful information about how to, you know, care for your pets, or whether it's pushing them towards social media where you're, you know, you've got, you know, other content, whatever that is, just creating that extra space. Because at the end of the day, this is your business. It's not Amazon's business. And the best thing that you can do for your business is to make sure that your customers are your customers. And so if you had something that was working, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, figure out a way to make that as white hat as possible, even in Amazon's eyes. And so I think the biggest thing there that you have to pay attention to is you had to collect their physical address because you're sending them a free product. Nobody says you can't send them a free product. That would be ridiculous to suggest that you can't provide free product to your customers. They're going to like that. It's good customer service. It's just that separation, you know, of the review from that process. If you can create months of space, or at least weeks of space, between those two events, it would be difficult for Amazon to really say too much, especially if at the point where you are asking for a review, again, you're just asking for a review. You're not asking for a five-star. Right. You don't say anything about a positive review. It's just, would you leave a review? You would have a lot of ammunition for an appeal if Amazon ever said anything.
Well, and I would just, you know, also add to that in the process, and we talk about this in the free course that we offer on After Purchase Funnel that I think is often overlooked but really powerful, which is, yes, it's nice to ask for reviews, but even before that, starting with that first interaction to say, hey, did you, you know, everything arrive as expected? Is the product working the way, you know, you were expecting? That type of things. Now, I imagine, you know, with lint rollers, your exchange or your return rate is probably fairly low. But even starting out with that, now, I mean, you're doing two things. One, you're providing good customer service, because if they did have an issue where, you know, maybe it was a manufacturing issue or something else that, you know, unanticipated, that 1% that have a problem that normally would just leave a one-star review because you know, it's a pain in the butt to have to return it. And now you were expecting to have it and you're going on vacation or whatever it happens to be with your pet. And now you can't pack the lint roller. You've got to go buy a different one. Yep. So providing better customer service, but then on top of it, really addressing those issues to prevent those one-star reviews, you're not manipulating reviews. You're just providing really good customer service. So I think that that can be really powerful. Yes, it's great to get five-star reviews, but it's even more powerful actually to prevent one-star reviews.
Yeah, for sure. Because every one-star review is, I mean, that's 10 five-stars. Like, I mean, that's, you need so many five-star reviews to be able to outweigh a one-star review. And it might be 20 or 30, you know, to really, you know, avoid that. So avoiding them is really a big deal. I would definitely return to that strategy and iterate that. You can't not do that. Because you know it works. You can't throw them away.
And then I would just based on what you described, Kyle, something else that I wanted to mention real quick was giving products for free is very powerful. Everybody loves getting something for free. And especially, you know, if you pay X number of dollars and you're expecting to get this product, but then you also get, you know, a bonus product, customers love that. Another way to think about that, well, really two things to think about that you may have already tried, but I'd be curious. Is the first is instead of a free product for every customer, doing a giveaway and making a larger prize pack. So that way it's less expensive for you because, I mean, you could give away a year's worth of lint rollers once a month to customers, and it's going to cost you way less than if you're giving a free product to each one of those customers. You know, and mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be, you know, you did a great example of providing, it doesn't have to be a lint roller. You know, it could be, you know, the ultimate pet lovers, you know, toy package or whatever it happens to be. The other thing is I think that there could be a great opportunity for you to find some partnerships within your niche for products that are complementary. There's a ton of different pet products out there. And I just wonder if, you know, you put together a bundle partnering with a few different companies with different products to say, you know, that you're not directly competing with and have no interest in directly competing with, but just say, hey, we've got X number of customers, you know, that we have on our list and that come in, buy our product every month. We'd love to have you, you know, donate on a monthly basis. We're doing this giveaway, X amount of product, and you could easily put together, you know, a few hundred dollars or even $1,000 worth of product from, you know, between you and kind of the brands that you partner with that provides a ton of value to your customers, doesn't really cost you anything, and then helps you kind of build some partnerships in order to get that off Amazon traffic piece that you were originally looking for without having to spend a ton of money or a ton of effort in order to develop that channel.
Love that. Honestly, there's just so many different ways. Suggestions, genuinely going back to, well, just starting with what you just said, John, I knew split testing a big giveaway is something we need to do. And I kind of forgot about it. So I'm glad you brought that up because I totally agree. We've yet to do it, but we totally should, just because if you don't test, then you don't know. And we have such a large volume, like that's why, especially for us, we should be testing since it's probably like 40,000 orders a month. So with that amount of volume, it's much easier to test, right? Compared with if we're only selling, you know, 1,000 units a month and scan rate is relatively low at 1%, it's just not much data. But since we have the volume, we can truly test, and it's just not being lazy. Because it's a bit much logistically to change all the inserts on all the products, and especially where we have them localized in certain countries. However, at the end of the day, it's not that much work, and we totally need to do it because I've heard some great success stories on people who would spend like $250 but get emails at, like, it was a case study I read once. I can't remember what they did. I think it was like some sort of camping package, and their cost per email ended up being like 40 cents or something. It's like a $250 or maybe a $500 giveaway, and they got tons of emails.
Oh yeah, giveaways, I mean, really, they're terrific. And like John was saying, if you can find a good partner who maybe has, you know, a fairly an expensive product with really good margin, mm-hmm. that, you know, maybe they can give some sort of a giveaway that's a smaller version or something else, but you both get the customer data. So they have the benefit, right? Like, they're not just going to give you that, you know, without something in return. So you both get the customer data. Well, now they can market to them as long as it's a good company. You've got to be careful with the partnership that you make. But those giveaways are terrific in that sense. The other thing I was going to get at was, you know, when you're, what's the best way to say this? Well, okay, so let's back up. A more important part of this piece that I wanted to ask you about. You said that you were using, that you're using an insert. How are you doing that with your lint rollers? Because one of the things that I know we found with our insert process was that we really spiked the engagement rate in terms of scans of the QR code by switching over to a different mechanism, let's say, that they had to interact with. So we sell pool tools. Anybody who listens to our brand knows mm-hmm. that. And in the past, we had just put in an insert. It just was in the box, you know, with the product. And we had a certain level of scan rate, which was not bad. I mean, to be honest, it was actually quite good for most Amazon sellers. I think it was because of our warranty and the giveaway that we did, but we were maybe, you know, in that 10% range, something like that. Maybe it was a little more. But we virtually doubled our response rate overnight when we switched from an insert to a hang tag, because we forced the customer to interact. If it's an insert, a lot of times it falls into the bottom of the box. Somebody doesn't see it. They throw it away, whatever. When we switch to a hang tag, so with our tool, you've got a pole and you got a tool, and they have to be, you know, they have to be mated together. In order to do that, they had to remove the hang tag because it was a plastic mm-hmm. loop that goes through the end, and then we've got a hang tag on the end. They can't insert the tool into the pole, nor can they attach the pole to a tool without removing it. So they had to interact. And we literally doubled our response rate on that. The other thing that's nice about a hang tag is that you can split test very easily because you never know which side of that hang tag the customer is going to see first. So you can put two different versions of the same message on that hang tag on either side. Mm. And then you just look at the scan rate. Whichever one gets the better scan rate becomes the new control, and then you iterate against that. So it makes split testing very easy. But in your case, the question I guess that I would ask is, was the insert something that they had to interact with? Or was it something that could easily get lost in the bottom of the package? And, you know, maybe that was part of the reason you weren't getting good scan rates.
No, it wasn't something they had to interact with. And that's an excellent idea. And I'll answer that just quickly. I did want to say I really appreciate your idea on lengthening the space between the reviews, just because I've lost video. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
We can still hear you. Yeah. And I actually still see you at the moment. So.
Okay. I didn't know if I had disconnected. Anyways, I've been terrified to jeopardize our reviews because I want to exit within the next year, ideally. So I don't want to mess around with anything that has any risk of, like, if we were to get our reviews wiped on our big listing, it'd just be like, you know, the sky is falling. So I definitely want to avoid that. But so thank you, because I'm probably going to very likely do that. I do want to get back to it, and I've been thinking how I can safely re-implement it. And I think that's the way, because I also we don't really need to optimize for reviews as much now. We have tons. Back to the inserts, though. We did test a bunch of different inserts, three major types, which is you start off with the typical rectangular square one that kind of everyone starts off with, or at least did 5-6 years ago. And then we switched to a credit card, and we tried different types of credit cards. We found that did increase the scan rate, but it still wasn't sufficient. Like, maybe it brought us like from sub 1% to 1.5%, probably not even 2%. And then we switched to a customized, it was the shape of a paw, like a cat paw, and that had a much better scan rate. But Mike, you saying attaching it to the product, like we could maybe put the lint roller through the cat paw or something, and that way they have to like take it off. Like, I think that's a really great idea, and that's something we could implement.
Yeah, just make it, I mean, it really, as long as it's something that they don't really have any choice but to interact with. And I would also say that consider the way in which they're interacting with it, and how can you best position the messaging so that the most important aspect of that message, you know, the thing that you think is most likely to get them to actually do something, is front and center at that point of interaction. You know, those are the things that I would really play around with, because I think I think it'll make a big impact on the scan rate that you're getting from that. The other thing to pay attention to as well, just logistically on that, is when you're doing your when you're setting up your QR code and stuff, one thing that people, they'll use services that they run those QR codes through this so that they can make them dynamic, so they can change where they direct and do things of that nature, which mm-hmm. is great, except then you're locked into that service, right? And so yeah. all of your inserts are gone. You have to keep using that service, even if you decide you don't like it or you're not using the other aspects of the service. Something that I would recommend is there's a tool called Switchy that right now it's on AppSumo. I don't know how long they'll be on there, but if you can purchase it through AppSumo where it's a single purchase, Switchy is nice because not only does it give you a lot of flexibility in terms of creating pixeled links, kind of like PixelMe's service, it also allows right. for the creation of QR codes. You can do split testing. You can change the location that the QR code is directed to. So there's a lot of things that you can do, and it's a one-time purchase. But I would definitely create a scenario where those QR codes can be redirected so you can change the landing page, you know, or you can split test the landing page, or you can send them someplace else. Give yourself as much flexibility as you can with those inserts because it gives you just more opportunities to iterate on that, even with the same inserts, you know, that haven't changed in your packaging.
Yeah. And that's
yeah. And I think the other thing I want to come back to is,
you have,
you know, Mike, you
made
a good point.
Provider. Sorry. I think me being in Thailand does lead to an exaggerated audio delay. Yeah. Yeah. I was just saying that.
I don't know if we lost him or not.
I think we might have lost him. Let's try this.
Are we
going to turn off my camera and see if that.
Likewise. Are you able to hear me?
Yeah. I lost the video feed.
Yep, I did too. So I think we lost him, unfortunately, yep. but I think that there was a good conversation around, you know,
Nothing.
Kind of building up those inserts. How do you get people in?
Hey.
Yeah, he's coming across broken.
Yeah. You guys can't hear me?
So I actually can hear you now. You broke up there for a couple of minutes.
Okay, is it clear now or can is you, it?
You're clear now. We don't have video, but maybe if we can just maintain your audio, maybe we'll be good.
Yeah, I figured I'll try disabling my video to give more stability to it. Maybe the Wi-Fi is being not great. But what I was saying, Mike, was we are using, I can't remember the name, but it's dynamic QR codes. So we can change it, but you can't split test or anything like that. And I love the idea of it. So that way we could have three different landing pages. So I've definitely noted that.
Well, and Switchy also is useful because of that whole pixel, you know, the pixeling feature, because then everybody that you go through that scan code, yes, you receive their contact information and whatnot. And so you could technically set up an audience on some platform or lookalike audience and stuff, but it does simplify it if you can just pixel them, because then you can run those campaigns without having to go through too much hassle. You can run remarketing on them, you know, almost immediately. So.
Well, I want to come back to something, Mike, that you said, and as far as partners. So one piece was, yes, if somebody has a really high-priced item. But the other thing for Kyle that I think might be good to look at is consumables. So in the pet space, there's, you know, food, there's, you know, supplements, there's a lot of consumables where, you know, maybe he finds that right partner that's willing to send out a sample size in order to, you know, get that customer contact information that essentially he can do it for free. So that's the other thing that I just wanted to add real quick as we're having this conversation that I think might be helpful.
Well, and one of the things that we talked about previously, John, in regards to a situation like that is, and maybe this would be useful for you, Kyle, because obviously on Amazon, one of the things that you're always trying to do is increase your click-through rate and increase your conversion rate. And one of the things with a partnership like that, and you could do it with your own product, but sometimes partnerships are nice in this regard, is that let's say you go to, let's just take an example. Let's say it's a pet food, right? Or a pet treat or something like that. And they're willing to give a sample to your customers in order to get that customer data and, you know, have more people trying their product, that sort of thing. What you can do then, and this is a way that you can advertise it or market it to this partner brand, is you could actually put that free item on your listing because it is a free item. It's accessible, right? So you set up with this pet company that does a pet treat, and then you could say, okay, lint roller plus whatever the free item is, whatever that sample is, you can actually put it into the listing. You could put a bullet point that says free whatever. The beauty is for the partner is that they don't only receive the benefit of the customer data on the back end for those individuals who actually buy or actually take advantage of it. They also receive impressions on your listing. So their brand is getting exposure, and you get way more impressions on your listing than you actually get sales. So if you market that properly to your partner, then you can basically, you're essentially selling to them brand impressions, you know? So yeah, it really is an opportunity where you have more leverage there, let's say, to get yourself a really good partner on that side, because they get a lot of brand exposure on your listing. So something to think about, because then again, you know, getting that extra free product on there, it's almost impossible for you not to get better click-through rate if you advertise it properly, and probably better conversion rate as well, which is going to spike your sales.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent suggestion. My only concern on that would be if you advertise it on the listing and then they have to go through a process to get it, I could see a large amount of people being like, then they have the expectation maybe that it would be in the box. Or were you saying to actually include, let's say, something physically in the package rather than it being like shipped to them separately?
You could test it both ways. Yeah, you could test it both ways. You don't obviously get the customer data if it's included in the package, but you do still potentially spike your click-through and your conversion rate. And because they're putting that sample in the hands of an actual pet customer, then there's an opportunity, of course, for that partner to receive sales from that. So the only drawback is you're not getting that customer data. I would say that there are certainly sellers out there that are using this strategy and that do advertise it on their listing and that do request the actual physical address, you know, of the customer to ship that out. I don't think you would likely run into a problem with it because it is accessible to them. But that's mm-hmm. something that you'd have to weigh on your own. Some brands will decide not to do it that way because they're afraid to do that. And I respect that. Other brands are going to be willing to push that envelope a little bit further to get that customer data.
Well, and I think it's how you frame it too. You know, if you frame it as a bonus item, for right. example, I think customers are much more understanding that process as opposed to saying like, hey, these two items come together. So if you kind of frame that as a bonus item or, you know, some sort of language similar to that, I think you set the right expectations that customers understand, oh, this is in addition to. And so when they have to, you know, put in their, you know, like their shipping address or whatever it happens to be, that they'll be more understanding that if you frame it properly.
I also think there might be a psychological aspect to that too. If it's a partner brand versus your own brand, there may be somewhat more of an expectation that makes sense because the partner has to ship it. You know, again, framing is right. is useful. So if on the listing, it's advertising it as a brand partner of some sort and they're getting their branding on there. And then when it comes time that the scan code and the landing page, all of that is, hey, our partner is going to ship, you know, whatever to you, right? Then I think, again, you're presenting that in a way that makes it less likely that somebody's going to.
So I apologize, gentlemen, and I enjoy this conversation, but I do need to wrap up here in the next minute or two. Kyle, any other kind of questions or follow-ups that you want to cover before we wrap up here?
No, I think that's a great ending point. But I want to say I've actually noted down both suggestions with the context on each of Mike's, you know, asking for the review later, just not including it all in that funnel. And then John revisiting the giveaways as I think that's super powerful. And I think it's our most reliable way to continue getting data from customers at scale, aside from getting like a viral social media ad, but you know, something that can consistently bring in people in a sustainable way. That's our power play moving forward. So we need to be utilizing it more, and we're just not, and both of those suggestions are super valuable.
Well, and I think also something to pay attention to, the fact that you're looking at an exit, is that customer data has a lot of value. And also right. having a process in place that gains that customer data, because it takes time to iterate on that and actually get that right. A lot of companies don't do that very effectively. And so if you're looking for an exit, knowing A, you know, when they come in, that they're receiving all of this customer data and not just an Amazon profile on which they can sell, right? But then also they are receiving the process by which you get that data, and they can just keep utilizing that. There's a lot of value there too. So in terms of your exit value, I think it's going to change things in a very positive direction, that you have the data and that you have a process that you can hand over to them to procure it.
Yeah, completely agree. And it makes a difference to add to that. Like we've only recently started really email marketing, like maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and we don't have too big of a list. It's about 5,000 people. And our last email did $1,000 in sales, and that's on lint rollers. So it's not like we're pushing, again, I constantly say that because there's a big difference between selling, you know, an exciting product or even a more high ticket product like you, Mike, like pool supplies, more functional, let's say. It's a bit harder of a sell. So it's definitely a real thing. And I would encourage everyone to not be lazy about their inserts and to really push that.
Yeah. And I think we've covered a lot here in giving folks an idea of different things that they can try depending on, you know, what works for their brand. And then, you know, Kyle, I just want to thank you for, again, for being on the podcast and, you know, our earlier conversation about different marketplaces and everything that's involved in there and some of the other conversations we had. Really appreciate you being on the podcast and providing some good background and understanding for folks that maybe are looking at expanding into other marketplaces and understanding what those challenges look like.
Thanks a lot, Kyle. Appreciate having you on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for tuning into the Brand Fortress HQ podcast. If you haven't already, hit the subscribe button and be the first to get new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday, where we'll continue to bring you the most actionable insights and strategies for fortifying your brand on Amazon and beyond. If you haven't already, please leave a rating and review. It helps the show grow, which means we can keep bringing you the best of the best each and every week. Finally, get access to our free after-purchase funnel blueprint using the link in the show notes. This full course will transform your Amazon game by showing you how to build and properly utilize a powerful customer list.